Our scripture passage this morning is Luke 22. I'm playing with my toy, yes. Yes, isn't that fun? Is Luke 22 beginning with verse 35. Luke 22 beginning with verse 35. Sorry, what was that? Oh, and all those that are... Open your paper Bibles, that's right. Oh, that's right, yes. And if you have an electronic device with the Bible in it, you may follow along. They're debating in some churches whether to turn on the Wi-Fi during services. I'm serious, because, you know, I mean, they use it, they have it on all during the week, and the thing is, well, if we turn it on during church, people will be playing Angry Birds on their phones in church. But the reality is that most of those people have a data plan anyway, and you can't stop them, and you're just preventing a few people who might look things up in their electronic Bible from accessing different versions. So maybe it's a losing battle. We'll turn on the Wi-Fi during church. Of course, that's not an issue here yet. you vote for what? But we don't have Wi-Fi. It's the problem. Then Jesus asked them, "When I sent you without purse, bag, or sandals, did you lack anything?" "Nothing," they answered. He said to them, "But now," this is verse 35, 36, "but now, if you have a purse, take it, and also a bag. And if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. It is written, 'And he was numbered with the transgressors.' And I tell you that this must be fulfilled in me. Yes, what is written about me is reaching its fulfillment." The disciples said, "See, Lord, here are two swords." "That is enough," he replied. This is one of those passages that when I mentioned it to a friend of mine, he said, "Well, is there anything that says you have to preach on that passage this week?" And my wife said, "Couldn't you just skip this one?" But those often turn out to be the best passages. So I couldn't skip it. And here we are. Jesus says, and this is my summary, "Remember how nice everybody was when I sent you off with no purse, bag, or..." Presumably, this is extra sandals. It wasn't that he was telling him to go out barefoot. If you go back and read in context, it was, don't drag along luggage with you. You're supposed to be able to move easily from place to place. If the people aren't receptive and they don't feed you, just go to a different place. And if they are receptive there, stay as long as you need to, heal the sick, raise the dead. And it turns out that method worked really well. People received them with open arms. Representing Jesus was good in those days. "I have bad news," he says. "Those times are over. Now you need to take your money. You need to carry your own supplies. And if you have to choose between the cloak and the dagger, pick the dagger. Why take the dagger in this context? For protection, it seems, right? Because being associated with Jesus now means, instead of being welcomed, they come to heal our sick and raise our dead. Now, being associated with Jesus means you're a criminal, an enemy of the state. So why take the sword over the coat? This is good. She said, because their sword can go right through the coat. Yes, and dead people don't get cold. Or maybe the reverse is true. Cold, dead people don't get warm when you put a coat on them. You followed that? But Jesus can't say that. He doesn't use a sword. Does he? I mean, in his whole ministry. Did Jesus ever use a sword? The sword of the Spirit. Yeah. But he didn't carry out acts of violence with a sword. I mean, the closest he gets to it, I understand he had a whip of cords, right? And in a couple of paragraphs, sorry, what was that? The tongue is mightier than the sword? Oh, the tongue is, yes. The pen is mightier than the sword, I'm told. In a couple of verses, or a couple of paragraphs, maybe it is, Jesus stops Peter from using the sword and undoes the damage that he did with it, says, that's enough of that. Later he tells, well, yeah, and if he really wanted them to get swords, why didn't he say, okay, two down, 10 more to go. Who else has got a coat? Right? But he didn't say, two, only two. We need at least a dozen. He said, that's enough. And later he tells Pilate that his servants won't fight because my kingdom isn't from around here. And it was true for a couple hundred years at least. His disciples don't fight. They were persecuted. They were chased from place to place. They were sawn in two. They were fed to the lions. They were persecuted in all kinds of ways. But they didn't fight. They didn't get their swords together and band together and fight back. And when the church did take up the sword, a couple hundred years later, that turned out to be a bad deal, didn't it? So clearly the kingdom of God is all about nonviolence, isn't it? I mean, as rightly practiced. Or is it? That isn't totally true. Jesus had disciples very early on who were soldiers. All right, there was the Roman centurion who Jesus healed his servant. In one particular case, pardon? Simon the Zealot was one, although Jesus put a kibosh on a lot of that zealotry, right? But there were Roman soldiers. In fact, when the soldiers came to John the Baptist and said, how do we repent, right? John the Baptist said, be content with your wages and don't oppress people. He didn't say, get out of the military. And Peter went to see a centurion after the vision that he had with the animals let down in the sheet. There were high-up Christians in the Roman military from very early days. And they were not second-class Christians. What about Moses and Caleb? And David, if we want to take some of the most obvious ones. And for that matter, what about the end of the world as we know it? Jesus returns in the book of Revelation as a warrior. In one place, drenched in blood. And it's not his own blood. It's the blood of his enemies, which flows out from the city at the height of the bridle of a horse. There is a time when violence and force are the only way and the appropriate way to stop evil. The trick for us is that sometimes we get a little carried away, and the force that's supposed to bring freedom ends up bringing oppression. It's hard for us to make that distinction between using force to stop evil and using force to get our way. But Paul appealed to the military and the Roman government for protection from those who would have done him harm. Right? When the Jews were coming after him and he was swept up into the fortress by the Roman soldiers, he didn't say, oh no, hand me over to them. When they brought him to the preliminary hearing, he said, I appeal to Caesar. Was he wrong to do so? Those soldiers were protecting him with swords and spears. It was the threat of violence on the part of the Roman military that kept Paul from being strung up by the Jewish leaders. Paul says that the governments of this world have been given the power of the sword by God to maintain order and keep crime and violence in check. There is a time and a place to use violence against evil, or in another analogy, to fight fire with fire. Sometimes that's the only way to fight a fire. Because there isn't time, you don't have the equipment, there's no way to dig a big enough fire break around the fire. The only way is to set a fire and burn it back to the fire. Oh, I didn't think about actually setting it up. I have a video clip from a video that I watched on a website called TED. Every now and then you hear me refer to this. It's the head of the Netherlands military. Not the usual kind of person that speaks to that audience. TED is a group of entrepreneurs and scientists and artists. They have conferences, well, I don't know, different places around the world. It used to be just one annual conference, but now there's all kinds of things going on. And people come and usually give like an 18-minute talk. That's sort of the standard thing. And this guy got asked to speak to this group. And he said, you know, I really appreciate what all of you are up to. You're out to make the world a better place. And some of you have chosen the microscope to do that as your instrument. Some of you have chosen the paintbrush. Some of you have chosen dance shoes. Some of you have chosen finance as your instrument of making the world a better place. And then he says, I made a different decision. And he walks over to the side of the stage where a young soldier comes out with a rather large automatic rifle. She pulls out the clip, checks the chamber, makes sure there's nothing in it, and hands it to him. And he comes back and stands in front of the audience. And he didn't say anything. He just smiles a little bit for a moment as there's kind of this ripple reaction through the crowd. And people recognize what he's saying. And he says, I chose the gun. Not because I want to shoot and kill and hurt people, but as an instrument of peace. And he goes on to tell how the use of force by democratic countries throughout the world, right, where there's checks and balances, where the civil government is in control of the use of violence, has reduced violence dramatically from the Middle Ages, where everybody had their own small private army. And he said, the fact that you all reacted the way you did to me holding this machine gun in front of you tells me that most of you are not around guns like this every day. That's a good thing. There are places in the world where that is not the case. And where people are threatened by people with guns on a regular basis. Warlords, gangs, terrorists. So the fact that all of you are maybe a bit nervous about standing here with this machine gun lets me know that we're doing our job and that things, the military in the Netherlands is having success. And that peaceable state, back in the Roman era, it was called the Pax Romana. Have you heard that term? That was the Roman peace. You know why it was so peaceful during the Roman period? Because the army was brutal, and people who wanted to start an uprising, or maybe today we would say be terrorists, and so on, got put down very quickly. And trade flourished, and the roads were built, and it suddenly became so much more profitable not to start a war that people weren't in the business of starting wars. And we live, relatively speaking, in a fairly peaceful period of Earth's history again, for much of the same reason, because we have, if this is the right word, legitimized use of force with checks and balances by our governments. We Adventists have tended to discourage military or police work. You know, how many Adventists do you know that aspire to that kind of a career? I've known two Adventist policemen that I can think of in my lifetime. One of them was the head elder of his church, which is interesting. The other was a former pastor. I'm not sure what to make of that. But the work needs to be done. And like with politics, maybe we'd be better served if some Christians were doing it. Do you follow what I'm saying? No? We wish that politicians were more honest and so on, but none of us will go into politics because it's so distasteful. I had a conversation with one of the spiritual leaders in our community who told me, I'm so glad that Chester Robertson is in, you know, the position that he's in. It's such a relief to have a Christian person with values, you know, involved at that level in our county trying to make things better. And I say, well, you know, I wouldn't blame him if he quit, but yeah, I'm grateful that he's there. We get into all kinds of trouble because those who are being tasked with the difficult job of policing evil are themselves prone to evil. I may have mentioned this before, but I saw another short film about a guy who did a bunch of statistics on the use of tasers by the police forces around the world. Because there's some discussion about whether tasers should be given to the military, because it's a non-lethal option, right? You know, if they're coming at you and you don't know if it's a suicide bomber, wouldn't you like to be able to do something besides shoot them? And they thought, oh, this will probably be a good thing. We should give these to the military so they've got something that's not a lethal option. But what they discovered is when tasers and non-lethal weapons were given to the police, they went from, they'd have four or five shootings by the police in a year to 500 taserings by the police in a year. And that when you have a non-lethal option, people tend to use it when they shouldn't. And there are stories of it was an 80-year-old woman who was tasered in her bed because she was menacing the police officer. Does this make any sense? Right? So we get into all kinds of trouble because those who are given the difficult job of keeping evil in check are themselves prone to evil when they're given force as a way of keeping evil in check. There are those who would say that the world would be a much safer place if the United States would reinstitute the draft. And I think they're probably right. Because with an all-volunteer military, no offense, sometimes you end up with people who glorify guns and violence being in the military. And then we wonder why atrocities happen or why nobody reports them when they do happen. And if we had a broader cross-section of our society serving in the military, we would probably hold our governments more accountable for the wars that they send them off to. Am I saying that we should not be non-combatants? You know, Adventists have a long history of non-combatancy. Well, as one movie writer put it, this was in a film, trying to remember the name of the film, it was actually a story mostly about a kid and his dog, but the kid's neighbor, an older young man who he idolized, was sent off to war, drafted and sent off to war. I'm trying to remember the name of it, it'll come to me. My Dog Skip, I think, was the name of the film. It was a good movie. It was a good movie. And the young guy comes back from the military having deserted. You know, so, I mean, he's ashamed and embarrassed to show up in his neighborhood again. And the kid who idolized him, you know, goes and talks to him. And he says, kid, it's not the dying that gets to you. It's the killing. And he deserted not because he was afraid of getting shot. He deserted because he couldn't handle shooting other people. So as long as there are roles to fill in the military or whatever that don't require you to kill other people, I'd say go for it. You know, take whatever non-combatant position you can get, recognizing that it's a gift to go through life without harming others, even your enemies, if you're able to do so. If you've ever seen the Desmond Doss story or, you know, read the book, it's just a fascinating contrast between his memories of the battles and the memories that all of his fellow soldiers have. Because he was there saving lives and they were there taking them. But the reality is, that's our military, right? Just because we're not actually physically out there pulling the trigger, you know, there are police. They're protecting us. There are instruments, if you will. Just like the gun in the hands of a soldier is his instrument directly, there are instruments indirectly. And we legitimize the use of force. They're doing that for us. We can't say that we have no part in it. We're a little more removed. We're insulated. We're protected from the psychological damage of committing acts of violence for good. But we're still responsible, and we can't just say, well, we're nonviolent and they're violent. No, we're part of that. And according to the Bible, in one way or another, that is legitimate. We need to have those checks and balances against evil. And we need people to do those things. Well, all that was just kind of an aside from Jesus' comment about, you know, those are all the topics that came up that I wanted to avoid when I read this scripture. And what do we do with this? Get yourself a sword. Clearly, however, Jesus was not expecting them to band together and defend themselves with violence. At least they didn't interpret it that way as we look down through history. So why the comment? You didn't come to church to be stumped today? So why the comment? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, well, but, you know, he did say, if you know, now I'm telling you, if you don't have a sword, sell your cloak to get one. And then he stops them too, and he stops them from using them. In the, you know, in the very act, I mean, this is what Peter said he would do. Two against them all. I'll lay my life on the line. I'm going to, admirable, really. I mean, he's defending Jesus. He's not, you know, doing it to get his way and just committing an act of violence. This is the very kind of thing that we just said, you know, stopping evil from happening. Certainly evil is what was happening there. But Jesus puts a check on it. So why make the comment? Well, one option is to say it's hyperbole, right? Just like he said, whoever doesn't hate his mother or father or brother or sisters, you know, and come after me is not worthy of me. Well, how can he say that at the same time saying, love your enemies? Right? It's a figure of speech. It's a way of drawing a sharp distinction. He's saying, it used to be that people would be nice to you in my name. Now they're going to be nasty to you. You need to think in terms of self-protection. You can't trust yourself to their hospitality any longer. He's drawing a sharp distinction. But let's get one thing straight. By drawing that sharp distinction, Jesus is predicting the future, right? It used to be this way, now it's that way. So what else must he know is about to happen with those very two swords? Did you read down? I didn't tell you to read down. Just a couple paragraphs. Where do those swords show up again? Read it out, Irma. Go ahead. Uh-oh. Yeah. Yes, it's down just, it's after the prayer in the garden section. Right. And then... Right. Right. Those are his comments to the people that came. But what happens then with the disciples and the two swords that Jesus had them collect? Yeah. Yeah, I mean... Right. Well, Peter actually says, or one of the disciples actually says, Lord, shall we strike with our swords? And without waiting for an answer, whack! And I have to tell you, Peter was not aiming for his ear. Right? I mean, you do not get out a sword and go, well, I think let me do surgery on your ear from over here. He was aiming for the guy's head. He was going to cut. And he was a fisherman, not a swordsman, so all he got was an ear. The guy, you know, like Peter went like this, and the guy ducked, and it went whoosh. And Jesus stops Peter, picks up the ear, dripping blood. I don't know, did he wash it off? I mean, I guess he's God. He can do divine super glue and sticks it back on his head. Yeah. And it stays. The blood vessels all reconnect. The nerves. Good as new. Just a little blood on the ground. Jesus is predicting the future. Does he not know this is what's going to happen with these two swords? Clearly he knows. So why make the comment knowing that that's, you know, when he's just going to stop him? I think he wanted it to happen. He said, two is enough. He didn't say, guys, it's just a figure of speech. Put those away. We don't do violence. Nor did he say, wait, two? We need 12. No, he said, I'm to be numbered with the transgressors. Two is enough. Because when they come for me, am I out here leading a rebellion? Does it make sense for you to number me with the transgressors when I could do violence against you and instead I heal you? Are you still going to arrest me? And did they still arrest him? The only legitimate use of violence is to stop evil that is completely unreasonable. And of all places, this was the time that it would have been legitimate to use violence. And Jesus stops the legitimate use of violence and heals those that are going to take his life. Just to show how ridiculous it was for them to number him among the transgressors. Numbered. It's an interesting phrase. He was numbered with the transgressors. He's quoting from Isaiah 53. I just got stuck on that word, numbered. Who wants to count transgressors? I mean, you know what I mean? There's enough of them, that's all I want. I mean, who wants to count them? Lord, I don't want to be in that number. Bad news. I am. Some of you don't like to be counted. You know, the the church likes us to count the number of people that are here, and I'm supposed to report that. And in fact, there's some new thing coming through. They want on the second Sabbath of the quarter and the seventh Sabbath of the quarter to count the number of people that are in Sabbath school, too. There's some big, you know, I mean, there are people that are doing research and they want to actually have accurate statistics. And so they're saying, please, would you please, on the second and seventh Sabbath, you know, at this specific time, so that we can say these numbers are legitimate for the research that we want to do. We don't like to be counted. We'd rather be anonymous. Thank you. I would like to be anonymous. Unless, of course, they're passing out Social Security benefits. What? You missed me? Can't you guys count? Right? We don't want to be counted if you think, you know, if I think you want something from me. Oh, they missed me. That's okay. But if they're passing out something good, well, then the government make a math error? You're going to be all over the news. How dare you? But if I were to be counted, I would come up on the tally of the transgressors' side for sure. And ironically, there's only one, count him, one who isn't in that number. Somebody miscounted. He could have righteously wielded the sword against them. In fact, when they came after him and he said, who are you looking for? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. He just says, I am he. And boom, they're all laid out. It was like they'd come up to the burning bush, right, where the I am was, and they couldn't stand it. And they still get back up and arrest him. It's almost like we get a glimpse of how the unrepentant will recoil in horror from the wrath of the baby sheep at the end of the world and call on the rocks to fall on them. Yet he does not use violence here. He is numbered with the transgressors. Do you know that God's into math? Mathematics is everywhere. Everywhere. It's all math. Karina was telling me her keyboard. She's got a fancy keyboard that will record, you know, what you play as you play it. But it doesn't record it in a what we would call a sound file. Even that is all, these days, it's all digital. It's all math. It takes what you've done with your fingers on those keys and turns it into numbers. That's essentially what it does. But with her keyboard, it's what's called a MIDI file. You can actually go back through and look at all the numbers. And if she's playing along and she hits the wrong note in a chord, she can go back in, find that one wrong note, change the number, and make it the right note. I mean, there's wilder stuff than that now, but they've actually got software that if you sing the wrong note, you can go back and fix it. And they've even got advanced software now that if you're playing a guitar, playing a chord, and you play the wrong note, or you just decide later that you want a different chord, they can actually pick the sound out of the chord, not a single note, it can pick the sound out of that chord, that one note, and you can change individual notes that were recorded from live audio. Amazing what you can do with numbers. And Karina was saying, all those notes are numbered, right? And there are some sour ones. Do they count? She said, and it's amazing because our brains are doing all this math without us recognizing it. You can just listen to the song, and she says, sometimes I just barely hit the wrong key. You know, I didn't full on hit the wrong note, but my finger hit two keys. And I can go back in and I find out, oh, yep, that's why that sounded funny. There's a B flat in there. It's only a 12 in volume, but I can just shrink that 12 down to zero, and then when I play it, it sounds great. Or the note wasn't quite at the right timing, and she can go in and she can just adjust the timing a little bit one way or the other. It's all music. It's all math. And our brains do all of that calculating, all of that incredible stuff with math, and turn it into music in our heads instantly. And we don't even recognize that that's all going on. Have you seen pictures of fractal geometry? Do you know what that is? I know, I said geometry, and Joy says, oh, I'm going to puke. Fractal geometry is very simple. If you take one pattern and repeat it with a slight maybe change of position or change of size, you use the same pattern, the same piece of information, but you can create an incredibly intricate design. And I saw one thing. They were just showing how to do this using Photoshop. They took three dots that look like this, you know, three green dots kind of overlapping each other. And they put them here and then shifted them slightly and grew them a little bit bigger every time. So it was just a little bit bigger and shifting them slightly. Pretty soon it makes this big swirl, you know, that looks like a paisley, you know, we see that kind of thing. But you keep expanding it and making it bigger and bigger, and it turns out it looks just like a palm frond. You know how the palm, not palm, a fern frond. You know how a fern, the end of a fern is all kind of curled around? I call them fiddle necks, you know, like a... That's because that fern is built with math. And it's the same pattern, repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating and repeating. God took one little mathematical formula and built a fern out of it. Math is everywhere. In fact, I saw something the other day. These people went into the rainforest and they cut down a single tree. And they measured the distance between the branches and the leaves and, you know, where the branches split off. And then they did a survey of, you know, 1 acre of forest and marked down every plant that was there. And they went back and they found out that there was a mathematical relationship between the ratios that that tree was built on, the distance between the branches, you know, and the leaves and where things split, and the density of the forest. They could predict exactly how many plants were in that entire forest by measuring one single tree in the forest. Right? Because God has built organisms using these repeating mathematical patterns. All right, enough on that. God is into math, all right? He does crazy things with math. He counts stuff that you and I wouldn't count. The hairs of your head are numbered. Some of them are transgressors. Karina cuts them off. Well, she's given up, right? She used to cut out my gray hairs. Yeah, they grow extras to fight back. He counts the number of righteous people in Sodom, even when the number seems insignificant. He counts. He knows the number of people in Nineveh who don't know their right hand from their left. The exact number, he can tell, Jonah, how many people in Nineveh don't know their right hand from their left. God counts things that we wouldn't count. And that doesn't mean that we've been reduced to numbers. He knows them each by name. Every soul who's ever lived or died or been aborted before even getting a chance to live has a number. And I heard about an autistic savant who could memorize huge numbers. He memorized the, you know, number of places of pi, right? The ratio of, I don't know, circumference and diameter of a circle to, I don't know how many, you know, thousands or whatever of places. Chester Robertson said he could recite it back faster than a computer could calculate it out. You know, I mean, he had it all memorized and he could do it faster than the computer. Eventually, the computer bogged down working it out to that many places. And people asked him, how in the world do you memorize huge, huge numbers like, you know? And he said, well, in my mind, when I think of a number, it has a color and a shape, almost a personality. Isn't that wild? You know, so 337, he could tell you what it looks like. Not the numerals written out, but it has an identity. And I think God could tell you, well, like what, McDonald's, they celebrated their billionth customer, right? I don't know, a few years ago they had this big fanfare and whoever came up to the register and was the billionth customer, I don't know if that was the right number, but they counted. I don't know how they did it. And they tried to identify who that was. I think God could tell you, Norm, you are the 756,483,345,101st of my children born on this planet. He knows. He's got your number. He's built a house for you in heaven with an address. There's a number on the outside so we can find you. He has numbered you among the righteous because he was numbered with the transgressors. Somebody ought to say amen to that. So one more question. Why sell the cloak to buy the sword? Why not sell the sandals or the bag? I don't know. You mean, is the cloak a wedding garment? I think there is some symbolism here. And we've already hinted at it. And so why does he say, sell that for the sword? Maybe. Yep. But he's saying, you know, you need to part with this to protect yourself. So it's not, you know, I mean, why not trust him to protect us? If we were going to make that, that's the analogy that he's making here. Now, I think it's all about the transition. Jesus is saying, those days are over, a new era has begun. Jesus came cloaked in humanity. When he said, I am he, and they fell back, they almost saw through, but they didn't. They didn't recognize him. He was disguised. His divinity was covered. But when they arrest him anyway, even in the face of healing, it's time to sell the cloak. And when he comes the next time, it will be bearing the sword. It's the transition between him hiding who he is for our benefit and him revealing who he is also for our benefit, even though it is to bring judgment the next time. Because now he has finally and firmly established that there is an unreasonableness to evil that cannot be destroyed any other way but with force. The cloak has served its purpose. Sell it and buy a sword. And the next time those people see him, that's what he'll have. And though it pains him to do so, he will number the transgressors accurately and make an end of them, and of transgression, once and for all. And then after the last battle, we can go on to live in a world without armies, without war, without violence, for eternity. Amen.